Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, the show that tackles topics important to you and your family. Finances, food, education, technology, and everything in between. We've got it covered on Mom Talk. Now, Mary Donnellan on Mom Talk Radio.
Yes, this is Mom Talk Radio and Mary Donnellan in for Maria Bailey. It is a pleasure to be with you behind the mic today. Again, it is the middle of summer and the dog days. And if you listened to the show last week, I told you a little bit about where that term came from, the dog days of summer, from the Sirius and the Sirius star, the dog in the sky. And it's from ancient mythology. So very cool. Google it if you get a chance. But regardless, it is hot. And if you are anywhere near a pool or the ocean or anywhere else, I hope you're enjoying it. Wear lots of sunscreen. Protect those kiddos. Also, put sunglasses on them because don't forget the sun, the UV rays that can damage your skin can also damage your eyes. And that leads me to actually one of my frustrations is that my daughter, my 10-year-old, we were going to the Keys for vacation over the 4th, and she gets on Amazon, of course, and she orders these cute little Ray-Bans, the little aviator-looking ones, and they were knockoffs, but they were polarized. Well, of course, it says kids Ray-Bans, and they come in, and they're toddler size. I mean, they literally are so – they're adorable, but they're so small. So, of course, this is the downfall of ordering anything online. I now have to basically print out a return slip, take it to the post office because I don't want to pay for it to ship back. Anyway, so long story short, to always read the fine print because the fine print gave the size of the glasses, and we didn't read it before we bought them. So – that's okay. That's a first world problem and we're not complaining. Anyway, we do have a great show lineup for you. We are joined by Dr. P. Jeffrey Phillips, who specializes in reflux in infants, which is a very common topic for moms of babies out there. If you have a child suffering from reflux, you'll want to listen to that segment. We're going to be talking to the Spotlight on Moms. Jennifer Bronsnick is going to be talking about the importance of resiliency and self-care during motherhood, which we know is important to take care of ourselves. We're going to be talking to a mom of three kids who's a yoga lifestyle consultant. And I do yoga. I love it. If you do, if you're thinking about doing it, please listen to this segment. It's going to be a great segment to learn all about how to use yoga in your life and schedule it too. And we'll talk to Dr. Paul Offit, and he is going to be actually talking about a controversial topic for many parents, and that's vaccinations, preventive health and vaccines for adolescents. So I'm going to be a really great topic to end the show. And before we take our quick break and welcome our first guest, I want to mention our new sponsor. We want to welcome ACT Kids Toothpaste. They are, it's as moms, we know how important it is to teach good oral hygiene habits to our children from a young age. Proper brushing, flossing, and rinsing are critical steps for a lifetime of good dental care. Go to actoralcare.com and click on the Act for Kids link at the top of the page to find great tips and tools for getting your kids to brush, floss, and rinse. And there's even a really cool brushing progress chart. And check out new Act Kids Toothpaste for Kids, which is for kids ages 2 years and older, please. With bubblegum and fruit punch flavors that kids love, 4 out of 5 parents say ACT Kids Toothpaste motivates their kids to brush. Find it at Walmart, Walgreens, and Target locations. And you can save money on ACT Kids Toothpaste at actkidssavings.com. Data's on file. Use as directed. When we come back, our first guest will join us for this episode of Mom Talk Radio. Stay with us.
This is Mom Talk Radio, the number one podcast for busy moms, Mom Talk Radio.
Our first guest is Dr. Jeffrey Phillips, also known as Dr. P. He is a researcher, clinician, and educator, and has worked in the academic environment as well as at Washington State University in Mizzou, University of Missouri, Columbia, and is an inventor of a medicine. We'll let him tell you all about it. Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Dr. P.
Oh, nice to be here. I think today we were going to try to talk a little bit about reflux in infants.
Right.
And people are often surprised that infants even have acid reflux disease. They say, oh, really? You mean like heartburn? Of course, they can't tell you they're having heartburn, so they do what they do best, and that is cry inconsolably when they're having heartburn. The difference between reflux and reflux disease is important because if you've ever picked up an infant and you know that they can spit up, that's reflux, but that may not be disease. Disease is when there are symptoms that may affect feeding, sleeping. You may notice that your infant is having congestion, arching their back all the time. Again, as I mentioned, crying inconsolably. You may be spending most every waking hour trying to get them to even get an ounce of their formula or milk. And the reflux disease, of course, is when you should seek help, because the disease itself can do things such as I mentioned, cause congestion, but also, did you know recurrent ear infections are commonly caused by reflux disease?
Oh, no. But why is that? Just physiologically,
well,
because of
the acid reaches up into the upper esophagus and into the airway, and actually where the eustachian tubes drain, which drain, of course, all the contents of middle ear, and you end up with inflammation of those eustachian tubes, and the drainage can't get out, and the bacteria move in into that area, and then you get an infection.
That makes sense. Okay, so when
we
talk
about antibiotics, and then we get resistant, bacteria over time.
Right. When you talk about, and you mentioned a few of the symptoms earlier, like just a constant crying and distress, basically, and recurring ear infections, that's another symptom, right?
Those are not as common. Of course, the crying is, but there can be crying can be for a number of reasons. But typically around feeding, they start crying. They actually may even learn to not like to feed because of the symptoms of the reflux, which occur when we put formula or milk in their stomach. The body starts making acid. The acid tends to float and it gets up into the airway or into the esophagus and causes these symptoms of choking, coughing, wheezing, can be some hoarseness. They'll stop feeding too soon. And of course, regurgitation. Then they may even have complete feeding refusal when they see the bottle coming or the breast. They were like, oh no, I know what happens when that. And so those are some of the more common symptoms. And like anything, we don't want to treat unless there are significant problems related to the acid, because as I mentioned, most all infants are going to be spitting up in their between the first few months of life. They're going to be spitting up, so you don't want to treat everyone, but when they start having symptoms, then you have to start thinking about the actual disease itself and what it's doing to the infant versus what will the antibiotic or what will the medicine do.
Is there an age range that we're looking at, and do they ever outgrow reflux disease per se?
Sure. There's not a lot of medical literature in that area, but it suggests that when they start walking, which can be a little variable for, individual infants, but about a year, most infants will outgrow. Now, some won't, but that's only maybe 5% or less that will continue to have some reflux symptoms. And it starts at about 2 weeks or a month. Can start actually as a newborn.
Right. So it just reminds me of, it's so funny when you talk about symptoms, when you talk about colic, like, can you talk about a baby, what we call a colicky baby, versus
colic,
where they draw the line between a serious issue that you need to see a doctor for, or it's just a fussy colicky baby?
Yeah, colic doesn't, it sort of is fussy. We don't know why they're just having quote unquote colic. But most, most professionals that work in this area in the medical field know that colic is just kind of a code word for something's not right. And oftentimes that can be related to, acid reflux disease. There's some, medical literature that shows that when babies had reflux events, the parents thought they were colicky. So, of course, colic can also come from gas, and gas can come from acid. Acid interacting with formula creates CO2 gas, which can either be burped up, in which case they get regurgitation, or it can pass into the duodenum where they get crampy and gas cramps that we typically see at that age.
Where does a parent seek treatment if they notice these symptoms or just have even a suspicion of something more serious than, as you said, just a colicky baby?
Right. For example, you may not be aware, but there's substantial support that sudden infant death is actually, in many cases, an acid reflux event that the baby didn't recover from.
Oh, so the acid, I didn't know that.
Into the lungs, yes. There's something called apparent life-threatening event, ALTE, where the baby turns blue. Parents, you know, are frightened. Usually it's a mother. They call the ER. They take, you know, they get to the ER, and the baby's usually recovered by that time. So reflux disease can be very serious and cause serious significant symptoms for the infant and the family. But you should think about recording or writing down some of the symptoms as you're seeing them. And we actually have a little infant questionnaire for reflux on the infantacidrefluxsolutions.com website. And it's helpful because the mother or the parent can go through and write down actual symptoms that are there for them, because they may not even be aware that wheezing would be from reflux or could be from reflux or back arching.
And the beauty of that actually is, so let me just give the website again, infantacidrefluxsolutions.com. And each one of those words has a dash in the middle of it. So it's infant-acid-reflux-solutions.com. The beauty of today's world is that you can take video too, right? Like you could ask, tell parents, take video of this infant in distress or arching their back or wheezing or, again, any of these things, and then submit and bring that with you when you see the doctor, correct?
Right. And so when you come in with data like that, it's very helpful because the baby may not exhibit the symptoms on command, right? So you're at the physician's office and they're not doing it. But yes, you take pictures, you write down the diary or the infant reflux questionnaire, and you can say, well, these are some of the things I'm noticing, and it gives a much clearer picture for the physician or the nurse practitioner that might be taking care of the patient.
Right. Well, excellent advice. Thank you so much. It's Jeffrey Phillips. Again, the website is infantacidrefluxsolutions.com with dashes in the middle of the words. And we will have that link on Mom Talk Radio when this show goes up, posts on the site next week. And when we come back, we'll shine the spotlight on moms. Jennifer Bronsnick is the mindfulfamily.com, and she'll talk about self-care and resiliency. Stay with us.
Mom Talk Radio, a busy mom's best friend.
So we shine the spotlight on moms, one of my favorite segments of the show, where I'm pleased to welcome Jennifer Bronsnick. She is the mother of 3 children, 2, 5, and 8. So young children. And she's blogging at themindfulfamily.com and tweets at Mindful Mommy, which is F-U-L-L Mommy. Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Jennifer.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
So with 3 children in those age ranges, plus a blog, and I'm sure a very healthy brand, how do you take care of yourself and promote resiliency for yourself and in your own busy life?
So the first thing that I do for myself and that I always recommend to moms is get sleep. So whether that means taking a nap, going to bed before 10 o'clock, getting that full night's sleep is to me the number one thing that moms can do to reduce anxiety, reduce their stress level, and allow their brains to sort of step in to make these really good choices around their health and well-being.
Do you promote napping when your kids nap?
For me, honestly, I couldn't nap unless I knew that someone else is going to meet their needs, because you never know when a baby's going to wake up, when they're going to poop, when they're going to need something. And so for me, and this is just my own personal experience, I found I couldn't let my body relax to actually fall asleep. However, what I could do is I would meditate. And I would take the pressure off taking a nap and falling asleep and allow myself to just take those deep breaths. Say, you know what, laundry can wait, dishes can wait, whatever else is happening can wait until there is some rest that's happening in your life. So, you know, I don't say, you know, I hate to put pressure on moms, because that's a lot of pressure of sleeping the baby sleeping. So it feels like, oh my gosh, I got to sleep. What if I don't sleep? So that doesn't necessarily help a mom's mental health. But you could say rest. I think that's a much better word to use, is rest while the baby's sleeping. And that's even at night too, sometimes, especially with new babies, their sleep's all over the place. So I love rest.
So So let's get on to some other tips. Give us some other tips that you like to promote for self-care and resiliency.
Yeah, self-care. So first sleep, then mindfulness. So having compassion for yourself, the situation, accepting what's going on, and tuning into that breath and body presence. We get into our minds, and when we can tune into our body, it helps to lower our stress level, reduce those stress hormones so that we can make really wonderful decisions. Bringing in gratitude every single day, thinking of a couple things that you're grateful for and a couple of things that you're looking forward to that you can send the gratitude towards. It hasn't happened yet, but trusting that it will happen. So taking time for self-care, and that's different for everybody. Everybody, I am not a gym person. I love rowing on a rowing machine. And so, you know, for me, that's how I move my body. But there's lots of different ways that you can move your body that feels good and doesn't add any added stress to your life. Finding ways to give back, finding something that you're passionate about, something that you care about, is really good for your mental health. Because anytime that you can look outside of your own, what's happening in your life, and see, wow, I really made an impact on somebody else's life, can be really, really powerful. And then, of course, always having love and compassion for yourself, your story, your family. You know, it's such an important skill, really. I mean, self-love is really a skill that we can cultivate. So, you know, I just want people to know that if they don't have it now, all of these things can be cultivated and practiced by taking very simple, quick steps to move in that direction.
Had you written an article about this or with these tips?
I did. So there's a blog that is all about really actually thinking about teenagers and but looking at resiliency. And so in that blog, there's a checklist. So going through that checklist for yourself, and you can sort of see, am I managing my anxiety and sadness? Do I know how to make decisions? Am I taking care of my physical and my emotional health? So there's a list that moms can look at for themselves and also for their kids, because it's helpful for us to know, okay, well, you know, we have to kind of have those tools first before we can bring them to our children. And so having these sort of checklist to see where we're at can be really helpful as just a roadmap. There's no right or wrong. Everybody's at different stages and places. And so it's just bringing that mindful compassion to your everyday.
That's great. And I love checklists. And I think all busy moms say thank you, because it, and you can just go through the list and be, you know, kind of just bullet points and make sure that we're covering the topic. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for joining us again. Jennifer Bronsnick blogs at themindfulfamily.com, and check out her, I think it's a May 2017 article that you are referring to for the checklist. But if not, I'm sure it's going to be front and center on your blog. And when we come back, we're actually going to continue on this kind the kind of mindfulness and spirituality journey. We'll be talking to Kia Williams. She is a yoga lifestyle consultant and a mom of three. Stay with us.
Mom Talk Radio, a busy mom's best friend. Now, Mary Donnellan on Mom Talk Radio.
So we're continuing the conversation about mindfulness and taking care of yourself. And one of the best ways that I know of and I love practicing is yoga. And my guest is Kia Williams, is a mom to three crazy kids and is a yoga lifestyle consultant to busy moms everywhere. And is also the author of the book, Secrets of an Energized Mama, How to Use Yoga to Juggle Your Life and Kids Without Burning Out. Welcome to Mom Talk Radio.
Thank you, Mary.
So how long have you practiced yoga? And as a matter of fact, not just practiced, but also then became a teacher.
I actually didn't know anything about yoga until I was an adult. So I've been practicing since I was about 20 and kind of started diving deeper into the other aspects of yoga about 15 years ago. So I've been teaching for about 10, 15 years now.
And do you have a particular, I know there's different, I'm going to say it wrong, I think, but like a very good friend of mine owns a studio and it's, Bikram. Is that right? Is there certain types of yoga, and do you specialize in one versus others, or do you do them all?
There are many types of yoga posture classes, and Bikram is one of those yoga posture classes. But I focus on teaching kind of the classical idea of yoga, which incorporates the postures and it incorporates other things that keep us psychologically and emotionally healthy as well as physically healthy.
Amen. We all need that. So you have three children. Are they, what age ranges? Are they younger, older? You sound young.
They're right in the middle at this point. I have my teenager. He'll be 12 next month, and I have a 10-year-old girl and an almost 7-year-old boy. So.
Oh, wow. So your kids are still pretty young. Yeah, I have the same age. I have two teenagers, and I have a 10-year-old, so I'm in the same.
There you go.
You're right. They're middle of the road. We're middle of the path.
Almost there.
So when you talk about yoga as a physical workout, do you do it by yourself? Do you go to a class? How for busy moms? In other words, I know it's hard for me to carve out that much time as in my day, but I know it's so important to manage some stress. So what's the best place to do to practice?
So the really cool thing about yoga as it pertains to us as busy moms is that you don't have to go to a class and you don't even need a yoga mat. So most of us in the West understand yoga to be these postures that we do in a gym or in a yoga studio. But yoga is really an 8-step system of living your optimal health and well life. So a lot of the practices that I teach my students have nothing to do with poses on the mat. They're things that help them calm their nerves, things that help them find more peace and calm their monkey mind, things that help them find more focus and more energy. And they don't need a mat to do it.
That's, and the funny thing is when you talk about, you were just saying like calm your mind. Sometimes I just can't. Like I have so much going through my head. How do you do that? How do you get your brain to slow down?
Well, the trick really is that most of us are never going to get our thoughts to slow down. As a matter of fact, if we got our thoughts to stop, we would be dead women. We wouldn't be alive. So what we're really doing is allowing that baseline, quote unquote, noise of thought to become like background noise so that what we're focusing on becomes what's most prevalent. So that's the practice of mindfulness. That's that mindfulness that yoga teaches us to do.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Your book, then, Energize Mama, do you talk about the 8 steps in it? Or tell me a little bit about the book.
Absolutely. My book, Secrets of an Energized Mama, is really designed to teach women how to use that 8-step system, 8-step yogic system, to find the peace and ease that they want in their mom life. So the whole goal of yoga is to find your optimum healthy self, right? You can call that ease, you can call that well-being, whatever you want to call it. But yoga takes us through 8 kind of sequential steps to help us get to that point. And the book talks about how to do that specifically for moms, because most yoga books were written by men for men. And this one is written specifically women, for moms. Yeah.
Good for you. And when did the book is available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble? You had mentioned before the segment. So it's the 8 steps in the book, and it touches on yoga and meditation, those kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. See, most people don't recognize that that meditation is actually one of the steps of the yogic system. So people try to separate them, but it's really a part of the same process that helps us take us to that healthy, happy place. And yeah, the book is available on Amazon, but they can also go to my website at nourish-motherhood.com to get to it.
Okay. So when you talk, with your house full of kids and your business and writing a book, I mean, you have time to do all yoga and have time alone? I know I try to stay by myself for 5 minutes and I've got, somebody knocking on the door, mom,
Oh my God. It's hard for moms to even use a bathroom by themselves. I still get knocked on the doors to the bathroom.
Exactly.
Can you take a pee alone?
Exactly.
But, that's the interesting part about yoga I'm a teacher. So I do find time to go and teach class and maybe I do my own practice a little while I'm at the studio. But when I'm home, my kids are a little bit older. So I get a chance to kind of sneak away and really 5 minutes is all you need. Part of yoga is breathing practices. So even if all you can do is sneak away and take 5 minutes for deep breathing to help calm your nervous system down and to recite a mantra, which is also a part of the yogic system that'll help you calm your mental chatter. 5 minutes can sometimes be all you need.
Interesting. So the mantras are, because I know when I try to do my yoga videos at home and, shut the door and, that's what they always start with, start with your mantra and keep coming back to that throughout your practice to keep your mind focused. And that's the challenge for me.
Exactly. Yoga is not yoga unless you have the breathing. Otherwise, you're just doing exercises. And there's nothing wrong with just doing exercises. They're beneficial in and of themselves. But you could have a whole entire practice of yoga where all you do is sit, breathe, or lay down and breathe, and that's still beneficial to your psychological and emotional health.
Well, for someone who'd started out and practicing even in their 20s, you've been very well-cited, and you've been on Fit Pregnancy, Huffington Post, Yoga International, Yoga International, YogiApproved.com. I mean, quite a list, an impressive resume. So really great work. So is this all, do you have any other books in the offing or anything else you're doing for your brand?
Absolutely. Actually, one of the things I've been kind of helping my students understand is how to use meditation as their kind of self-care tool. Because like you mentioned earlier, Mary, that sometimes you can't take away 30 minutes and actually get on a mat, or maybe you have an injury or something that doesn't allow you to do the postures of yoga. But almost no matter what your health situation is or your fitness level is, you can practice meditation and you still get the same stress-reducing, immune functioning, elevating benefits as a yoga posture practice. So I've been teaching my students a lot about that, and I actually have a free mini meditation course that I offer to my community to help them understand the benefits of meditation, how it works scientifically, and how they can actually fit it into their mom life.
Great. Is that at your website, nourish-motherhood.com?
Absolutely. They can get it
right
from there.
Thank you so much. It's Kia Williams. Again, the website is nourished-motherhood.com/meditate. The book is Secrets of an Energized Mama, How to Use Yoga to Juggle Your Life and Kids Without Burning Out. If I could say those words together, I just am having tongue tied today. Sorry about that. And that's available
right
on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, but go to Kia's website and check it out. And I think I've heard so much about meditation. That's the thing that's really, so you're saying it's just part of the bigger umbrella, more or less.
Absolutely. It's part of the yogic system.
Mm-hmm. All right. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. And when we come back, we're going to reach back into the archives and come up with one of our favorite segments and a favorite guest. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break.
This is Mom Talk Radio, the number one podcast for busy moms. Mom Talk Radio.
This is Marian for Maria, and we're continuing our discussion about moms and our happiness and stress-free lives. And we're actually going to talk about expectant moms with Dr. Ali Domar. She's the author of Finding Calm for the Expectant Mom and is a founder and executive director of the Domar Centers for Mind-Body Health. And she's a busy mom herself. She is driving right now to get her daughter, and she is in on the Mass Pike driving to the Berkshires. So welcome to Mop Talk Radio, Dr. Domar.
Thank you so much. This is a classic mom, you know, doing two things simultaneously.
Yeah. So as our producer said, let's stay safe. You're on your Bluetooth on your phone, and that's good. We're glad you can find the time to talk to us. So let's talk about it. So your book, you're the author of the book Finding Calm for the Expectant Mom, and it's all about what? Tell us.
People always ask me why I wrote this book, and I say there are two reasons. One is that I think there's a societal pressure for pregnant women to glow, to be radiant, to be happy, to be serene. And, you know, I'm a psychologist, and I see pregnant patients pretty much every day. And for a lot, you know, yes, there's certainly some women who love every second of their pregnancy, and I never see those women. But there are a lot of women out there who find it hard to be pregnant. You know, you can have physical symptoms, you can have psychological symptoms, and people often don't feel okay complaining about it. And so one of the reasons I wrote the book was to say, you know what, a lot of these things that you're feeling, the uncomfortableness, the depression, the anxiety, it's really normal. And here are ways to feel better while you're pregnant. I was writing a blog the other day about irritability, and I was listing all the reasons why pregnant women can feel irritable. And you know what? There are a lot of them. You know, you get hungry, but you don't know that you're hungry because you're nauseous. And you're really tired because you're not sleeping well at night. And, you know, you and your partner may be responding to this pregnancy in different ways. And weird people come up and touch you. I just saw a patient today. She's sick and tired of perfect strangers coming up, putting their hands on her belly.
The belly touch, yep. It's very random, isn't it?
So intrusive. So,
yes.
You know, and then, you know, your in-laws might say you have to name the baby Pen. Or you just don't feel like you're most attractive. Or, I mean, there are a lot lots of reasons why you should be irritable right. while you're pregnant. And I consider that normal. But, you know, if you're the average woman who goes into social media and all people talk about is how great they feel, it makes the average pregnant woman feel like she's not doing a good job being pregnant, or maybe she shouldn't be having a baby. And, like, no, this is hard. It's hard work to build a baby.
Your book basically sounds like the realistic guide to pregnancy, the up, the hot, the good, and the not so good. I don't want to say bad, because actually only amongst my girlfriends, like my really close girlfriends, would we ever say, oh my God, pregnancy sucked, you know, or parts of it yeah. did, not all of it, but there were parts where you just were like, that was not fun.
Well, you know, I was talking to a colleague of mine a couple of years ago, and I was telling her about writing this book. And she said that a strange thing happened when she got pregnant with her second baby. She was talking to a colleague of hers who had, like, two perfect pregnancies. And when the perfect colleague asked my colleague, you know, how are you doing? And my colleague said, well, you know, I'm really nauseous. I'm having a hard time sleeping. I'm having leg cramps. And the perfect colleague says, oh, yeah, that's right. I forget you hate being pregnant. And my colleague is like, no, that's not it.
No, I don't. Yeah.
No, I love the fact that I'm, you know, bringing my children into the world. It's just, I'm talking honestly about how uncomfortable it can be to be pregnant. And
right,
people misinterpret
right.
that. So it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay to complain about it. And so, yes,
right.
the book is about acknowledging that and trying to fix the things you can fix so you can feel better.
If you're struggling with pregnancy emotions, where does the red flag come in that it's probably something a little bit more?
You know, I'm getting really sick and tired of this huge battle that's being sort of fought in the obstetrical and psychiatry world as to whether or not a woman who's pregnant should be taking antidepressant medication. And everyone talks about either yes, she should, or no, she shouldn't. And no one ever talks about what the alternatives are. There are other things that can treat depression other than medication. And so clearly, if a woman is severely depressed, if she's suicidal, if she's having suicidal thoughts, if she can't get out of bed, if she's, you know, if she's hurting herself because of her depression, then of course she should be on medication. There's no question. But
right.
for the 90% of pregnant women who are taking medication or have a history of depression, maybe it's a better idea to try other things first, and specifically cognitive behavior therapy, which has been shown over and over again to be as effective as medication in treating mild to moderate depression.
So other than medication, there are options and women should explore.
Absolutely. You know, I'm not saying don't take medication, but I'm saying maybe try something else first, and if it doesn't work, then try medication.
Right, right. And the website is Dr. Alice, A-L-I-C-E, Domar, DOMAR.com. And we'll have that link up on Mom Talk Radio next week.
Mom Talk Radio, a busy mom's best friend.
To round out this fantastic episode of Mom Talk Radio, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Paul Offit. He is the director of the Vaccine Education Center and attending physician in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and is advisor to the Unity Consortium. Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Dr. Offit.
Thank you.
So, you know, I have to be honest, it's a touchy subject when you talk about vaccines. There's two, usually two, sometimes more than that, schools of thought about the effectiveness, the risk benefit, more or less. But according to a new survey conducted by the Unity Consortium, what's the breakdown of parents who were surveyed?
Well, I think what they found was that mothers generally trust doctors, that adolescents also generally trust doctors. I think adolescents, however, didn't feel that they necessarily needed to see a doctor, including about vaccines, although I would push back a little bit on the two schools of thought. I think that, you know, vaccines are a scientific issue, and so the issue of whether vaccines are safe or effective are a scientific one, and the science has been very clear. Vaccines are safe and effective, including the vaccines that are given to teenagers.
And I don't disagree with the science part of it, but when it comes to the mom community, it's more of an emotional distinction I was making. In other words, some moms just feel like even though you can put all kinds of studies and research in front of them and the science in front of them, they still feel like, well, I heard my neighbor's son had some reaction, or, you know what I mean? That's what I was speaking to.
No, and it's a good point. I think, and it really does relate especially to one particular vaccine given to teenagers, and that's the human papillomavirus or HPV vaccine, which is, you know, a vaccine that prevents prevents known causes of cancer. And, you know, there are every year there are about 29,000 people who will suffer cancers from this virus, and 4,000 to 5,000 will die from those cancers. Yet it's arguably our most underutilized vaccines. Frankly, it's a national embarrassment.
When it comes to then teen vaccines, what are the recommendations for teens, and what age do we start? And the HPV, all my kids got it too, but because I believe in the science of it. But what other vaccines are required?
The American Academy of Pediatrics, a number of years ago, set up essentially an adolescent platform. So the 11 to 13-year-old is recommended to receive three vaccines. One is the meningococcal vaccine, which prevents a bacteria that can cause meningitis and bloodstream infections. The second is a combination vaccine, the Tdap vaccine, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, mm-hmm. or whooping cough vaccine. And then the third is the human papillomavirus or HPV vaccine, those three.
Okay. So, and do you recommend flu vaccine for teens?
No, good point. So the influenza vaccine, right, is a yearly vaccine for everybody over 6 months of age in the United States.
And what else did the survey point out in terms of the attitudes toward vaccines?
I think the surprising thing was the sort of the disconnect between the notion that parents and teenagers, you know, thought that, you know, doctors generally were a good thing, that they should go to doctors. But I think that they sort of saw themselves, at least as teenagers, only having to go to them when they're sick. Although if you look actually at the vaccines that children get, we're pretty good about getting children to get the meningococcal and Tdap vaccines, but we're much less good at getting them to get the HPV vaccine. So it's not just a matter of not being able to go to the doctor. I think when they go to the doctor, still that's a vaccine where people are hesitant. I think for the reasons that you said, this sort of, although it's not a scientific controversy, it is, as you point out, a cultural controversy. There are, mm-hmm. you know, fears that surround that vaccine that don't surround the other two vaccines.
And I think because it in the timeline, it's relatively new, correct? The HPV vaccine?
Well, it's been around since 2006, so it's more than 10 years old.
But on the timeline of, let's say, compared to meningococcal,
the vaccine really became a routine recommendation around 2005. So it's not, there's not that big of a difference. But I think the problem is that, you know, the human papillomavirus is transmitted by only one means, and that's sexual contact. And I think there's discomfort, I think, among clinicians when you have an 11 to 13-year-old child sitting in the office about recommending that vaccine. So I think often what the clinician will do is they'll say, you know, today you get the Tdap vaccine, you get the meningococcal vaccine, and we also have the HPV vaccine if you want. So I think they tend to be softer about recommending that vaccine, in part, I think, because they're uncomfortable talking about sex, although I would argue they don't have to talk about sex. They just have to say that this is a cancer-preventing vaccine.
Which is, I think, what my pediatrician said to me. So, and honestly, it's a subject that, you know, you just have to bring up as kids learn more and more in younger ages. So where do our listeners find information about what you just spoke about earlier, as well as just in general information? Public education, I guess, is what I'm looking for, the website.
Yeah, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has a website, which you just can see, Vaccine Education Center, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, it comes right up. And also the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Immunization Action Coalition. There are a number of groups that put out excellent information about vaccine safety and effectiveness.
And the information I got from our producer is that there's a website, unityforteenvax.org. Is that the Unity?
And that's another important one.
Okay, so it's Unity and the number 4, teenvaxvax.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Offit. Great information. And you can check out this website, as well as all the websites for the guests on the show today, on MomTalkRadio.com next week. Maria will be back behind the mic. Everyone have a wonderful, fantastic week.